This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking at where Britain is at in its retreat from the EU. We'll also be marvelling at the wondrous and sometimes infuriating jargon that we've invented to describe Brexit. And finally, we'll be asking whether British aristocrats are being seduced by the new glamocracy. Like Hercules, Theresa May keeps having extra labours added to her tasks, says James Forsyth in this week's cover story. Every time she believes she has done something to finally move the Brexit process on, she is immediately told that there is something else she must do. I'm now joined by James and Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, to discuss. So James, it seems like it's been a slightly bad week for Theresa May. Are there any glimmers of hope at the moment?
It has been a bad week for Theresa May. I think she arrived on Monday. Everyone became very optimistic that there were going to be sufficient progress to move on to the next stage. And then this whole question of the Irish border threw a massive spanner in the works, with the DUP basically making quite clear that they couldn't live with the text. And it's also opened a whole can of worms within the cabinet about how close Britain is going to stay to the EU in terms of rules and regulations after Brexit. This is the most explosive issue in the Tory party, and Theresa May has never even let the cabinet discuss it. But now this text appears to imply that in big sectors of the economy, the whole of the UK could be choosing to stay in line with EU rules even after we leave.
Do you think that was a big mistake, not letting the cabinet discuss it?
Yes, because it means that Britain has never known what it actually wants out of these negotiations. And as I think the Greek experience shows, the EU will always try and make you jump through more hoops. And you have to know precisely what your bottom lines are if you're going to negotiate successfully.
Yanis, you've of course negotiated with the EU. Do you think it was naive for Britain to think that it could quite easily get a deal?
Well, Britain didn't think that. Theresa May thought that. We should not conflate Britain with the hapless resident of number 10 Downing Street. Theresa May made two basic mistakes. The first one was the day after the Brexit referendum. She interpreted the result as a definite vote, not for simply getting out of the EU, but also getting out of the single market and ending free movement. I thought that that was, firstly, an indefensible interpretation. As long as only 1% of those who voted for Brexit did not necessarily identify exiting the EU with exiting the single market, it was a false reading of the referendum outcome. And the second mistake she made was to promise that she would be able to squeeze a decent free trade agreement, including services, which of course has a major impact upon the United Kingdom, out of the Article 50 negotiation. That Article 50 negotiation was never going to result in the kind of free trade agreement that she was promising in the British public. So these are two major errors that created a prison in which she has entrapped herself.
Yanis, do you think at this stage it's more likely that we're going to leave without a deal?
Well, look, there are four options that, in a sense, boil down to two. The first one, which seems to be what the government is deluding itself into believing possible, and David Davis has warmed towards, is that the story about the regulatory alignment that has been promised the DUP would apply not only to Northern Ireland, but also to the whole of the UK. My point of this potential option is that if the United Kingdom wants to align itself at the regulatory level with the EU in order to make all these promises hold some credibility, the only way of doing it is a Norway-style agreement. But this is, of course, not what David Davis is talking about. So this is a delusion. The second option is for Theresa May now to confront the DUP, to call their bluff, and simply try to use the threat of the government falling and, you know, a Jeremy Corbyn government emerging as a means by which the DUP can be cowed into submission. The third option would be to start the negotiations all over again with the European Union and with Dublin. Again, that I cannot see being countenanced. And finally, the fourth option, of course, is the hard Brexit that you mentioned. The process that she has allowed herself to be trapped into is leading to a hard Brexit, to something like a hard Brexit with maybe Canada-style free trade agreement on goods. This is why I have been advocating now for a while that the only sensible, small-C conservative strategy for the London government is to file an application for a European Economic Area Norway-style agreement that would, at the cost of Mrs. May taking back the promise of an immediate cessation to free movement and exit from the single market bring about the best possible outcome for the United Kingdom.
James, at this stage, what do you think we can expect before Christmas?
Well, I think if Theresa May was to file an application for EEA membership, I think her own position in number 10 would be very jeopardised. Because the fundamental problem that Britain has in this Brexit debate is the referendum showed a fairly evenly divided country, 52-48. But the problem is, splitting the difference doesn't work. Because if you join the EEA, you essentially end up as a rule taker, having to accept rules and regulations that you've had no say in making. So I think that is the problem of joining the EEA as anything other than a stopgap solution. I think before Christmas, I think in government there is still some optimism that they can get to sufficient progress because they think that there is a political will on the EU side to basically fudge things enough, offer some EU reassurances to Ireland and hope that you can somehow stumble across the line. But as I said in the magazine, though, even if Theresa May does that, that only takes her into the much more difficult bit of the process, which is she then has to come back to the cabinet and she has to say, right, this is what we actually want. And the cabinet are deeply split on what the UK should want out of this trading relationship.
Yeah, and as you've, of course, written many times about the need to reform the EU, do you still think that Brexit can be the catalyst for that?
Well, before I answer that, I must comment on what I just have heard now. There's no doubt that sufficient progress is going to be declared at some point. Very little doubt, I should say. But that is not the issue. That is besides the point. The end of the first phase of these negotiations with Mr. Barnier is, as you just said, quite correctly, is only going to take us to the second phase. During that second phase, there is zero probability that the European Union is ever going to grant Theresa May that which she needs in order to fulfill her promise of a mutually advantageous agreement for Britain. So, to put it bluntly, this process is going to end up either in a hard Brexit at the 11th hour, which will be absolutely detrimental to Britain, and I do not think it's going to do much good for Theresa May's career as Prime Minister, or it's going to lead to a Norway-style agreement. There will be no other option. The Canada plus-plus option is an absolute delusion. There is no way that Brussels is going to offer anything to Britain without Britain becoming a rule taker. So either Theresa May must swallow the bitter pill of being a rule taker with the very serious benefits that will result from a Norway-style agreement, from remaining within the single market. That involves a resolution of the problem with the Irish border. It involves maintaining access to the single market, especially for financial services in the City of London. It will involve giving the House of Commons a period of 5-6 years, if this is the period during which the EEA agreement lasts, to have a proper debate and actually to restore sovereignty to the House of Commons regarding the transcription of EU law into British law, and in the debate about what the long-term arrangements between the United Kingdom and the European Union should be. It respects Brexit because when you are, as Norway is, outside of the EU, Brexit has been respected. But she has no good options. This is one for her option that she could sell as a small C conservative option. The alternative is a hard Brexit that very soon is going to create a financial and economic dynamic that will totally and utterly undermine the Tory government and Theresa May's prime ministership. So now let me turn to your question. Is this going to be a catalyst for the EU reforming itself? Certainly not. I was always very negative when I heard people on the continent saying that, well, the silver lining of Brexit is that Paris and Berlin, in particular, are going to get their act together. They are going to see what happened in Britain as a wake-up call and therefore use it as an impetus for reconfiguring the European Union in a way that democratizes it, in a way that reduces the degree of authoritarianism by which it functions, help it shift from an intergovernmental to a more federal set of institutions. It is happening. All we see is a doubling down. We see the further retreat of the European establishment into this combination of authoritarianism and inanity. Think of the general election in the federal election in Germany. Europe did not figure at all. It was not an issue in the German elections. Even in the negotiations between the various parties in Germany, the FDP, the SPD, and of course the CDU and the CSU, reforming Europe was not even mentioned. It is quite astonishing how the Brexit shock has left the continental European establishment completely paralyzed regarding the major reforms and transformation that the European Union should respond with to the Brexit conundrum.
Just finally, you've obviously negotiated a lot with the EU. What would be your advice at this stage to the Prime Minister?
End the Article 50 negotiations. They are designed to fail. They are designed to lock you into a process that in the end humiliates you and at the 11th hour forces upon you either to rescind the Article 50 process and stay in the EU or just to exit without any deal that you can sell to the British public, even to your own party, as a success story. And the only two ways of ending this Article 50 process are, one, simply pull up stumps and leave, which I do not recommend. Awful for Britain, and it wouldn't be good for the peoples of Europe. Or alternatively, send Mr. Barnier home and file for an EEA application with a time-limited contract of 5 to 6 years on the basis that this is the best way of serving the most powerful argument in favor of Brexit, which is the restoration of sovereignty to the House of Commons. Because if you have a transition period where Britain is not in the EU, but it remains in the single market on the basis of an EEA agreement for 5, 6 years, you give the House of Commons the opportunity without a gun on its head to consider Britain's options in terms of its arrangements with the EU in the future, and also detoxifies the political process, both within the United Kingdom and with the European Union. Angela Merkel suddenly breathes a sigh of relief because whatever happens in the long term becomes a problem for the next German Chancellor. Therefore, the conversation between Theresa May and Angela Merkel is going to become civilized and constructive. And in any case, I'm astounded that the party calling itself Conservative is opting for a plunge into the darkness and into a hugely uncertain year zero kind of transformation of its relationship with its greatest partner, with a penchant for characterizing a small C Conservative transition period during which Britain leaves the EU stage by stage, first by getting out of the EU, but not out of the single market, and then considering whether it wants to leave the single market and what that would mean, considering this to be treacherous. I mean, this is quite unbelievable. This is an extreme radical position that just goes to show that the Tory party has been taken over by radicals for whom the economic costs and the social costs of their policies are not the main show in town.
Look, I think there is a time-limited transition already. There's 2 years where Britain will essentially, if this can be agreed, Britain will essentially be a member of the EU but without voting rights. Now, I think where Yanis talks about a time-limited EEA membership, I think that is in some ways sellable as long as it was time-limited. I also think that there's a kind of risk of linguistic confusion here, which is originally hard Brexit meant leaving the EU without a deal. If the UK were to negotiate first an Article 50 deal, then a transition period, and then even just a pure Canada-style free trade agreement, that would not be a hard Brexit in the kind of proper meaning of the term. I think the challenge for Theresa May is that when the EU says your choices are Norway or Canada, that is obviously in some ways a negotiating position, and you could probably massage some things around the edges. But it is basically correct. And I think it would be more sensible for the UK government to start thinking, OK, if we're more likely to end up going down a Canada model route, what do we do in the service sector of the economy to increase its global competitiveness that can compensate for the new barriers to trade on restrictions on access to the EU internal market?
That was James Forsyth and Yanis Varoufakis.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Brexit means Brexit, or so we were once told. And as the process of Brexit continues, a host of new words have joined the British lexicon. But do we have any idea what they mean? I'm now joined by Mark Forsyth, author of A Short History of Drunkenness, and Sam Leith, our literary editor and the author of Right to the Point. So, Mark, let's start with Brexit. What do you make of that word?
Well, Brexit means Brexit. I think we can all agree on that. It's a rather lovely phrase. It's got good diacope to it, like home sweet home or burn baby burn, to be or not to be, Brexit means Brexit, oh captain, my captain. And it sort of reminds me of Gertrude Stein's A Rose is a Rose is a Rose, and A Kiss is Just a Kiss. I think it's beautiful. The poetry-wise, I'm fine with it all.
Poetry-wise, but has it made it any clearer what Brexit means, aside from...
Oh, no, I've no idea about that.
Sam, what do you make of Brexit as a term?
Well, I mean, Brexit's a relatively recent coinage, isn't it? And I think it first appeared on some sort of briefing document for a hedge fund or something, if I remember rightly, about 3 or 4 years ago. And then various spin-offs like Grexit and Lexit and so on. But Brexit now, obviously, is the one that's the most important one. And I think that circular definition is, of course, it's a bit, you know, it's a Buddhist cone. It's a kind of perfect instance of something that's, you know, it sounds like it means something but doesn't. I mean, obviously, we all know that Brexit means Britain leaving the European Union, but as it's become clear, nobody actually knows what Britain leaving the European Union actually means anyway. So it's a question of unpacking the definition, isn't it?
As Dot says in her piece this week, these new phrases seem to be coming thick and fast at the moment. The new one that we keep hearing is regulatory alignment. Why do you think the language is evolving quite so rapidly?
I think regulatory alignment is there precisely because it's impossible to say exactly what it means. It's something to do with regulations, something to do with being roughly aligned. That's the thing. It's a fudge term, a term where everyone can get behind for a brief moment, and next week we might find out what it actually means, at which point we'll get a new name for it. I have noticed that usually in politics, the big struggle is to name something first, get your name on it. Because if you can call it, say, the bedroom tax, then that means it's a tax on bedrooms, even though no tax is involved. Similarly, you know, Michael Gove was very clever to call them free schools, as though all other schools are captive, involving chained up little children. But it's very hard to argue against free schools or to argue for a bedroom tax. And it's surprising that since Brexit, nobody's been jumping in trying to name things. At the time of Brexit, they did it very well, and people jumped in with things like the three Brexiteers, you know, that sounds great, and Remainer. Remainer was such a boring name. Even if you drop the, you know, the term Ramona or anything like that, it's very hard to cheer on going, yeah, let's remain, or just sounds so dull. Whereas nobody seems to be jumping in with any proper memorable terms here, like, you know, the Irish solution or something like that, which would be a nice let's all get behind this kind of thing.
I mean, I think one of the reasons that we're in such a fog of kind of complication and ambiguity is that, of course, quite deliberately, you know, this attempt to have one's cake and eat it means that in diplomacy, they're trying to find forms of words that various people with entirely irreconcilable demands can understand in the way that they want them, so they can save face or they can read into them what they want to hear and go first. I mean, I was very tickled by the fact this phrase, you know, continued regulatory alignment, was actually, apparently at least, was redrafted from no regulatory divergence. and the difference between no divergence and continued alignment. And people are trying to kind of split the difference, say, oh, well, you see, alignment is where you've chosen to do it, whereas no divergence is when you're simply following somebody else's lead. But of course, you're in exactly the same place on the face of it. So this is, we're in the territory of what Henry Kissinger, in a memorable phrase, called constructive ambiguity.
The thing is, you can be ambiguous, though, and be more memorable. I mean, I just thought up the Irish solution off the cuff, but I think that's great. And they're welcome to it if they want it.
Yes, but they'd have to define it, wouldn't they?
Oh, no more than they need to define regulatory alignment.
Isn't that the joy of it?
The joy of words is the meaninglessness of them, and that you can multiply them forever.
Sam, we obviously like blaming lots of stuff on the EU. How much do you think we can blame these sort of strange bureaucratic terms coming into our language on the EU?
Well, I mean, it's obviously nice to blame everything on the EU, and blaming everything on the EU is obviously historically what's got us where we are. I don't think, I mean, in fact, most of these contortions are contortions that have come out from the British government as they sort of struggle to try and find a way of framing difficult, sometimes impossible conundrum. At the moment, there is something that I think does feed into all this, which is that the abstraction and the complication and the difficulty of understanding what the hell all the bureaucraties means is a useful negotiating tool in itself, because you can use boredom as a rhetorical strategy. If you want to make something that's difficult or contentious, you know, if you want to make people not pay much attention to it, framing it in a way that's extremely boring, it's the political equivalent of burying it in the small print. A zingy phrase will draw attention, whereas a kind of snoozesome piece of bureaucratese allows you to know that 80% of the ordinary people who might otherwise pay attention will almost certainly have changed a channel and be watching Strictly Come Dancing.
Mark, how much of this do you think is actually designed to deliberately confuse people? I mean, I, on our Coffee House Shots podcast, have to keep having all these terms explained to me. Is that a deliberate thing, do you think?
I think, yes, confusion, and as Sam rightly says, boredom. I also think, I mean, you know, a classic reason for having any kind of jargon is exclusion of the outsiders. And to go back to what you were saying about, are the EU to blame for these incomprehensible stuff? Absolutely not. We've been doing this for years and years and years. People would make fun about government jargon in the 17th century. But, I mean, if you go back just in the 1980s and watch your Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, Sir Humphrey there, this is before, I mean, the EU is 1992, I believe. Sir Humphrey and the British Civil Service were deliberately making stuff boring and incomprehensible for decades before the EU came along with their boring incomprehensibilities. But all governments have boring incomprehensibilities. I'm sure if you went and actually, you know, talked to the Sentinelese Islanders, who are an uncontacted tribe in the Indian Ocean, they've probably got a little bit of it going on.
Just finally, can I ask you both whether you have a favourite or a least favourite Brexit term?
Are they all allowed to be my least favourite?
You can have them all if you want.
I don't think there have been any very good ones, really.
Apart from the Irish solution.
That's brilliant, yes.
The thing that irks me that it's intended to is Ramona, because it's, you know, brilliantly but very unfairly casts those of us who spend our time wailing like Cassandra that this is all a disaster, as people are simply kind of moaning on about something rather than as we at least think of it ourselves as people are pointing to the imminent cliff edge of actual disaster.
Yeah, we will probably see the hard Brexit or soft Brexit, but I think we've got chewy Brexit. That's my contribution.
Yes, like a sort of nougat, particularly delicious nougat with bits of broken glass in it.
That was Mark Forsyth and Sam Leith. And Sam also hosts our book podcast, where this week he's joined by the Russian historian and activist Marcia Gessen. The world may be dazzled by Prince Harry marrying a divorced, mixed-race American TV star, but his grand friends and royal cousins will hardly bat an eyelid. They've been marrying celebs for the past decade, says Harry Mount. I'm now joined by Harry and Sophia Money Coutts, the novelist and writer, to discuss. So, Harry, you mentioned this thing in your piece called The Glamocracy. Can you explain to us what that is?
Yep, it's my new word to explain what is replacing the aristocracy. So, as you said, in theory, it was very surprising that Prince Harry should marry a mixed-raced American celeb divorcee, but actually, in a funny sort of way, they come from the same class, which is this new glamocracy, which is based on looks, fame, and money, which both Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have. And, as you also said, it's been going on for a long time. So Ben Elliott, Camilla Parker Bowles' nephew, the entrepreneur, has married the daughter of the rock star Stevie Winwood. Zara Phillips has married rugby star Mike Tyndall. And it goes right on down through the aristocracy. The next Marquess of Bath has married a mixed-race model. And so it's actually nothing new in aristocratic or even royal circles to marry outside what were once considered posh circles.
Sophia, is this something you've come across, the glamocracy?
Yes, I think, I agree with Harry that it has been happening for a while. Although I suppose if you look at Kate Middleton, she's sort of become part of it, hasn't she? She was quite a normal sort of slony girl.
She's unlike that,
and
yeah,
she has glammed up and got the, you know, big thick hair and the dresses and the nice nails now. Yeah, she doesn't totally fit, but I think it has been happening for a while. But then to a certain extent, t'was ever thus, if you look at, I think you mentioned your piece, like Rita Hayworth.
Or Consuelo Vanderbilt,
Vanderbilt, yes, back in the day. So it has been happening for quite a long time, but I suppose this is the most obvious, very exciting, recent example of it.
But I think there's a slight difference there, that Consuelo Vanderbilt was the famous 19th century American heiress who married the Duke of Marlborough because he was semi-broke and needed to fix the roof on Blenheim Palace. And they had a very miserable marriage because they came from entirely different worlds. Mm. And my point in this article is actually this glamocratic world is actually the same for a rich American as it is for an upper class Englishman. That old cliche, which is kind of true of the upper class Englishman, with dog hair on the bedspread, bottle of claret at lunchtime with a grouse, wearing tweeds, it's sort of gone largely, not entirely for Sloanes under the age of 40 or so. They've become much more like rich Europeans or rich Americans. So they still have these different backgrounds in theory, but they talk very similarly. Even Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, even though she's obviously got an American accent, they speak in the same sort of therapy speak. They wear the same sort of fashionable clothes. Mm. They're trim. They go to the same gyms, have the same shrinks.
Well, you mentioned your piece, this blue suit that Harry was wearing, that Jared Kushner also seemed to.
Yes, exactly. I noticed he wore almost exactly the same suit, Prince Harry, for his engagement interview as Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, wears, which is, they're both very slim, tall, good-looking, but very neat, dark suits, white shirts, and dark, simple ties. Mm. And there's another son-in-law of sort of constitutional royalty. So it's just that, actually, the English aristocracy, because it's once again very rich, those families that have managed to hold on to the Acres and the Rembrandt,
the Dukes and the,
they're now no longer on sort of lower terms than the Consuelo Vanderbilts of this world. They're all of the same international jet set class.
That's true. I still like the idea, though, that there's obviously, you know, there are still English traditional pastimes that Sloanes go in for, right? So like shooting weekends and going to stay in drafty big houses where there's not enough hot water. I still quite like the idea of some of the sort of glamocracy struggling a bit with that. Because I remember talking to someone once who, this is a few months ago when Harry and Meghan had been dating for a bit, someone, a sort of Sloane, suggesting that she might find some of those shooting, tweedy shooting weekends and sort of country weekends quite difficult because there is still, they still, you know, do those sort of things which nice American girls might find quite different to sort of Hollywood life.
But actually, even those places, as you know, Safar and I, both of us, go to these sort of places the whole time, those old country houses, once very drafty, dog hair on the coverlet, etc. Lots of them have now been upgraded. Do have ensuites? Yeah, they've got central heating, ensuite
bedrooms.
Exactly, and because those, as I said, those upper class families that have clung onto their land and their pictures are incredibly rich now. So that, I think it still exists in houses lived in by older aristocrats, but I think that's changing.
Mm-hmm. No, I would say that's fair.
Harry, you mentioned in your piece also this idea of meritocracy. Do you think that's always been a pipe dream, really?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever existed. The idea that a, you know, very clever child, poor clever child at birth, is going to find his right place in society while the rich, stupid child drops down. It just doesn't happen. I don't think it's ever really happened. And I do think it's really good at the same time that the barriers to entry into the elite class in this country have collapsed. I think it's wonderful that a mixed-race American divorcee is marrying Prince Harry. But actually, you're replacing the old aristocracy, which is incredibly unfair, with not so bad, but still barriers to entry based on money, looks, and fame.
Yeah, I think it's like a creeping sort of Americanization, I suppose, isn't it? You don't have to have blue blood these days to marry someone else with blue blood. You just have to have sort of money or fame. That's the point, I think.
Yeah.
And what happens to members of the aristocracy who aren't glam enough to be in the glamocracy?
I think if you're not in the glamocracy and you are a sort of tufty Sloane still, you probably marry another tufty Sloane and you have a very happy life because that's all you want is a sort of house in Gloucestershire and a Labrador. That's
fine. It does still exist, but there are but there are quite a few, I bet, Lady Celia Frumpworthies who are very, very depressed as of last week because they might have been dreaming of marrying Prince Harry.
Yeah, I think my mum was a bit sad.
Still time.
Sorry, Mum.
do you think, I mean, snobbery, do you think that still exists within the glamocracy, or is it all just about money?
I think it depends on the generations. I know that there's been a bit of sniffiness amongst sort of older generations about Meghan, more about, actually, interestingly, about the sort of divorce thing than anything else.
Oh, really?
Talk to a sort of couple of crusty oldies in the past week who've been more sniffy about the divorce thing, I think, than anything else, unless they're too embarrassed to mention the mixed race thing. That might be it, I don't know. And they're using a divorce thing as a sort of stick to beat her with. But yeah, no, I don't think really with anyone under 40 there's much snottiness about it. If anything, they'd be all for it. They follow these people on Instagram as well. They're, you know,
there is something Charles Moore pointed out in his column last week in The Spectator, which is true, is that I could see no snobbish attacks on Meghan Markle in the papers when there were so many against poor Kate Middleton.
Kate had a much sort of harder time.
And it's because we can't place the markers so easily with Meghan Markle. You know, we are still slightly obsessed with class in this country. Someone opens their mouth and you can immediately judge where school they've been to and all the rest of it. If you're from an entirely different country and also you're famous in your own right like she is, the snobbish attacks just don't happen. So snobbery does still happen, but I think it's much less than it used to be.
Actually, yeah, that reminds me of a piece that I wrote for Tatler a couple of years ago about Guy Pelly marrying Lizzie Pelly and American girls marrying British boys again. I spoke to a sort of very grand titled toff who's in his 30s, and he said exactly that. It was much easier to bring home a girl from Louisiana and no one would question her accent than, you know, bring home a sort of dustbin's daughter from Essex that his mother might frown upon. He said exactly that.
And you can't play the famous name game that the upper classes play, where you introduce them and you say, my name's, I don't know, Nigel Richardson. And they say, any relation of Lord Richardson? No. Any relation of the Marquis of Richardson? No. You can't do that with Meghan Markle or someone from the other side of the planet.
Yeah.
That was Harry Mound and Sophia Money-Coutts. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Americano, our look at American politics, hosted by Freddie Gray. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Chris Mullen, Melissa Kite, and there's an interview with John McDonnell. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.